All right, well, we have a few people watching. Let me just roll this intro thing and officially launch into stuff. All right, here we go. So, hey everyone, happy Friday once again. I'm joined by the one and only Seth for Privacy. How's it going, man?
Going pretty well. Yeah, glad to be on. I don't get to chat Zcash stuff very often, so it'll be an interesting conversation.
Yeah, for sure. So this is the Zcash podcast number 4, funded by the Grants Committee. So thank you guys for the opportunity to do that. And for me, it's been a great learning experience because I have wanted to get more into the outside of just the straight up crypto is cash, crypto is payments kind of bubble and into kind of deeper sections. And privacy has been a big one that I'm obviously very, keen on. And I'm good friends with Naomi Brockwell, i.e., Miss Your Phone is Spying on You. So yeah, it's definitely good to get into. And obviously, I think one perspective that we don't always get is I would say, I guess you could say an outside perspective, but a another side. And a lot of times you don't really know what is without knowing what isn't. And it's good to kind of go to the other side. So, real quick, would you mind for the viewers at home, as they say, just introducing yourself and your work, what you do?
Yeah, so name is Seth, or Seth for Privacy is what I go by in the space. But I've been in the cryptocurrency space now for, I think, going on 5 years. So crazy that it's already been that long, but a while by cryptocurrency standards. Got in mostly to Bitcoin originally, and then got kind of pulled into Monero initially just to mine it, but had an interest in just kind of the hobby side of things, mining it from home. It was a fun task, so I jumped into that and kind of fell down the rabbit hole of why privacy matters. Really, thanks to the Monero community. I mean, they were very welcoming and were willing to explain things to me as somebody who had no interest in privacy, no interest in digital cash or freedom money or any of these concepts that I think are pretty core once you kind of dive down the rabbit hole a bit more. And walk me through why that mattered, why we needed privacy, not just in money, but obviously why it was so important in the money that we use, that we have the ability to gain strong privacy, and ultimately why it's important to have strong privacy by default, so that even noobs like me at the time could get privacy without knowing what it was or how it benefited me. So that kind of started my deeper journey into understanding why specifically Bitcoin and Monero mattered, and why they were powerful tools for freedom. Since then, have shifted a lot into kind of the broader privacy space. I have a podcast called Opt Out, where I talk about kind of all things personal privacy, trying to be a very approachable podcast for that goal. And then I've recently started working with Foundation, who are a Bitcoin-centric sovereignty company, essentially. Right now, our focus is Bitcoin hardware wallets, but branching out pretty quickly within the next year or so, to kind of broader digital sovereignty. So that's kind of where I'm at right now. Core passion, obviously, it's in my name for privacy. Core passion is really finding ways that I can help to onboard people to the idea of personal privacy, help to find them tools that work well for them, help them to define their own threat model, and then really to go from there.
Yeah, so for the elevator pitch, I mean, I don't want to play full on John Stossel and be like, well, yeah, nothing to hide. Why do you need privacy? But what's kind of your pitch for privacy? Like, why to you is it important, not just for you personally, but for society to get into? Why does it matter that this is something we even focus on to begin with?
Yeah, I think you can go a lot of different angles. Like, when I approach it, I usually kind of try to see where the person I'm talking to is coming from. I think if you look kind of at broader societal impact, privacy is absolutely necessary for personal freedom. So, like, even though I focus on privacy, it's not privacy as the means to that end of just being private. Like, I don't really care that I'm just private. That's not the goal. The goal is that I can wield privacy as a tool towards better personal freedom. And we see that both on the individual level and at the societal and national level, even where if we have no privacy at the individual level, democracy or even a dream of democracy dies completely at that point, because it's very easy for the state itself to control and coerce what happens if they know what everyone's doing, thinking, saying, who they're meeting with, who they're talking with. So that's kind of the broad strokes of it. If you're talking more like on the personal level, I think a really interesting idea that has been just pitched to me by somebody that I had on my podcast a long time ago, whose name is Smuggler, which is always fun. But he
smug guy.
Yeah, he's an amazing dude. Knows everything. I don't really know how, but he knows everything. But he actually pitched privacy as being core to who we are as people. Where if we talk about like you as a human, as an individual, the things ultimately make you different from me are the things that are unique to you. That a lot of times that even only you know, or that only you share with people that are really close to you. So the idea of like individuation comes through privacy. Because you get to choose what's unique about you. You get to choose who you are. And a lot of that comes with the idea of privacy. And then also that the idea of like human relationship and intimacy ultimately comes through privacy as well. Because if we're not able to choose who we reveal information to or not, we can't have intimacy. We can't ultimately have deep, meaningful relationships. Because the thing that makes like the relationship between myself and my wife intimate and close is that we know things about each other that no one else knows, that no one else will ever know, most likely. Mm. And a lot of that is what binds us together as individuals as well. So those are kind of the broad strokes. Ultimately, I think it was Snowden who summed it up very eloquently as privacy is just simply choosing how much of yourself you want to reveal to the world. It's not that you want to hide everything necessarily. It's also not necessarily anonymity, which often gets tied with that. But ultimately, it's just giving you the choice to reveal as much of yourself to the world as you want, or as little of yourself to the world as you want.
Yeah. And so for the average human being out there, right, obviously people watching this podcast already at least surface level care about privacy if they're kind of into this. But let's just say I'm Mr. Normie McGee. I got like a regular old office job. I got a family. I pay all my taxes. I follow all the laws. I even drive the speed limit most times. Like I'm kind of a boring person, to be honest, but all that kind of stuff. Why do I care if Amazon knows exactly what kind of stuff I purchase? Why do I care if the bank, why do I care if MasterCard is following my carbon scoring of all my purchases? Cause I'm also a vegan. So they like that. And then why do they care? Like, why would they care if like I send money to grandma or take money from grandma? Cause it's all above board. I'm super above board. I'm a transparent person. Why does this straw man that I'm making of myself need to care about privacy?
Yeah. I think again, there's always several reasons and nuance, but from the, like, I mean, this, there's just commonly this idea that like privacy equals criminal activity. And it's a very strange idea because everyone I know who cares about privacy, as far as I know, is not a criminal in any way. I abide by the law. I pay my taxes. Like I'm not this super shadowy hacker guy who kind of does things quietly and sneaks around and breaks all these crimes. But I love privacy for two main reasons. One is that I'm able to protect myself against hackers, against data leaks, against breaches, all of these things that have just become a superfluous part of digital life. I mean, we're all used to being in breaches. We've all been notified of some breach that we've been a part of, that our bank has had, that our ISP has had, that our electric company has had. I mean, at this point, basically everyone's been hacked at some point or accidentally leaked data. And when we don't care about privacy, those breaches become much more harmful. For instance, if you're using your full personal name, you're using your same email address that has your full name in it on every account that you own, using the same password in every account that you own, which is a security issue as well, but also a privacy issue because it easily gives access to all of your info to people. If one breach happens, it's very easy for that hacker to try and get access to other accounts. It's easy for them to connect the dots between other accounts that you have online. That's like one piece of it, and that you can limit the damage that breaches have to you when you're able to control how much data those companies have. If they get breached and all they know is an email alias and that's it, maybe you paid with Bitcoin, maybe you paid with Monero, maybe you paid with Zcash, and just an email alias. Oh, well, just disable the email alias and you go about your life. No harm done. But if you had paid with your credit card and maybe that company stored the credit card information for some reason, you paid with your full legal name, you had your full address in there, all of that information, that becomes very valuable to a hacker. So that's like the very low-hanging fruit. And that, I think everybody can stick with that one. I think where it becomes more up to like personal choice is how do you view the companies that you're giving up this data to? Because most of them, I don't think, are malicious in intent, but a lot of their practices end up becoming malicious. And if you look at a Facebook, like Facebook as a company, Meta as a company now, I don't think they were started to be some malicious superpower, but what they have become is essentially a malicious superpower. And when you choose to give them all of your data, you're equipping them to be able to essentially try to craft you and who you are. Because ultimately, mm-hmm. Facebook or Meta want to make you someone who consumes their content, someone who stays on their platform, someone who does everything within their ecosystem. And they want you stuck in that walled garden, and they want to make you someone who's more pliable for their ends. And that's true of large businesses like Meta. That's also true of nation states who want to do the same thing. So when they have all of the data about who you are, where you go, who you talk to, et cetera, it's a lot more easy for them to try to craft you into a essentially like subservient being to whatever purpose they have, rather than, again, you being a very individuated, unique individual that is autonomous, that you have your own self-sovereignty at that point. So those are kind of the big ones. Obviously, there's tons of other ones depending on where you are coming from personally, but those ones kind of jump out at me.
Yeah. And so one of the key, I guess, elements of using crypto, using a different kind of decentralized pseudonymous currency, is to obtain some sort of privacy. And obviously, back in the day when, so like when I started using crypto, which was just Bitcoin back then, I was, what, 2013, so like 10 years ago, over 10 years by now. And I remember in the early days, like I didn't understand it very well. I remember just being like, this is my address, but no one knows who's behind it. And like very simplistic thinking. It's where I remember actually getting mad when they came out with HD wallets, because now I have these other addresses. I'm like, I just want to use the one I'm used to using. I just didn't get it at first until I, you know, kind of realized. So I think a lot of people at the surface level kind of think, I would say normies at least, or and even crypto normies, I would say, at the surface level are like, I'm using crypto, therefore they can't see what I'm doing. So regular use of something like Bitcoin, how private is that actually, or how easy is it to, I guess, compromise that kind of privacy?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it comes down to how you've acquired it and then how you use it. So, I mean, if we, like, when we look at Bitcoin, ultimately, people kind of thought it was anonymous, or at least like that's the pseudonymity was good enough, mm-hmm. like you mentioned. But I think, thankfully, people have started to realize that really what Bitcoin has is extremely fragile pseudonymity. So that pseudonym, those Bitcoin addresses that you use to receive funds, can be very easily linked together usually. They can be directly tied back to your identity if you're buying your Bitcoin on an exchange that has your personal ID and all of that information, what we call a KYC exchange. Mm-hmm. And if you're doing that and you're withdrawing to a Bitcoin address, your identity is directly linked to that pseudonym, which isn't the pseudonym anymore because the exchange knows exactly who you are. And likely the government and law enforcement know exactly who you are because there's commonly data sharing going on there. So it quickly falls apart. At that point, there's not really much privacy at all. The other main issue is that most wallets in Bitcoin don't provide any privacy, and they just let you send and receive as normal, and they just embrace that fragile pseudonymity, which in some cases is good enough. Really, if you can come in and buy Bitcoin in a way that doesn't link your identity directly to Bitcoin, even the fragile pseudonymity can be okay for many threat models, especially common ones. If you're not, I mean, if you're living in like an oppressive regime, that's a very different situation than if you're in the US and a normal kind of law-abiding citizen. You don't have the targeted threat model that many others would. So it really depends. The thing with Bitcoin is that you can have vastly different tiers of privacy. You can have essentially no privacy or very little with that fragile pseudonymity when you've bought Bitcoin on a KYC exchange. And you can also have very, very good privacy if you learn to use a few of the tools. If you buy Bitcoin directly peer-to-peer or on a non-KYC exchange, you can have very, very solid privacy it's usable, it's functional, it's not amazing, it's not super user-friendly. But again, it's plenty of privacy for those who understand how to use it. But that comes down to the core of where I've always landed with privacy tools is I want these tools to be something that not just the tech-savvy, techno-elite can approach and use. I want it to be something that everyone can use.
Yeah, absolutely. And so over the years, people have thought of a whole bunch of different ways of imparting a greater privacy ability to cryptos like Bitcoin, but then quickly kind of expanded far beyond that. And I believe was Hal Finney was also thinking about adding more privacy to Bitcoin. I remember I believe Satoshi was talking about zero knowledge proofs at one point. And so why don't you give a quick rundown of like some of the major, I guess, privacy preserving technologies that are, or approaches that are added to cryptocurrencies. So yeah, let's start with CoinJoin. So CoinJoin is obviously where you and other parties all mix your funds together, break them into small pieces, mix them together, and then get different pieces to the same amount. And then when you send them, it comes from the big jumbled mess and no one can really tell where it came from. Now, obviously, over the years, there's been a giant sliding scale of CoinJoin implementations. There's been the old school tumblers and mixers, the centralized ones that always end up exit scamming or getting shut down by the feds or whatever. And then there ends up being like Xiaomian CoinJoin and other stuff like that today, and just everything in between. So how good is CoinJoin at actually preserving your privacy?
Yeah, so CoinJoins themselves, it's hard because, like you said, CoinJoin as a term is really just like a very generic term that describes that idea of a collaborative transaction where you work with other people to hide or obfuscate the true source of funds for a given output. Mm-hmm. So it's very general. There are tons of different approaches. There's dozens of different approaches that have been theorized and put out there. Right now, there's really only there's three core approaches that are in use today on Bitcoin, two that are by far the most used. One of them is a wallet called Wasabi Wallet, which now uses the protocol called Wabi Sabi. And then there's the Samurai Wallet, which uses a protocol called Whirlpool. And essentially, I'll focus on Samurai because that's the one that I'm most familiar with, the one that I also use.
Interviewed those guys for this channel, not this pre-Zcash podcast, but also mm-hmm. on the channel. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. They're fantastic guys. I've really enjoyed getting to know them and being a part of their community. But so their approach, essentially what it is when you go to mix funds, you choose what pool you want to join. Essentially, that's just choosing what size output you want to have on the other end. So like 0.01 Bitcoin, 0.05 Bitcoin, 0.5 Bitcoin, and you'll enter funds. The funds will get broken down into those specific denominations and then mix through. And what a mix looks like is when you actually create the transaction, you collaboratively create this transaction with four other people. Four other entities, I should say, because it could be less people, but at least four other people. And when you do that, essentially what you do is you break the deterministic links between the activity for that specific coin, that specific UTXO before the mixing round and after. There's no way to directly tie between the incoming UTXO and the outgoing output. So it breaks that deterministic link. Oftentimes you'll do what's called remixing and you'll continuously join new mixing transactions to provide better privacy for yourself for the long run. But their protocol has been proven to work over the long run. It's something where like you want to check court cases, you want to check law enforcement documents, basically everything that's out there on is someone able to trace through this. And so far, as far as I know, there have been no cases of tracing through Samurai Wallet's CoinJoin, either by a chain analysis firm like Chainalysis or CipherTrace, or by law enforcement. So it certainly can be effective. The main problems with CoinJoin are that you have to opt into it. So obviously it's not the default, but not only is it not the default, when you choose to do a CoinJoin, it's completely clear on chain that you chose to do it. Even if they can't chase after it, they can still see that you opted into this privacy preserving tool. Which can be harmful to your ability to spend funds after that. Usually that only affects you on like KYC exchanges and stuff like that. But that's a potential issue. And then the other one is that you stand out on chain from other just regular transactions, which is similar, but those are the main issues there. But they do provide strong privacy. They are usable today. And the tooling around them is rapidly improving.
Yeah. So, first of all, as far as like the showing that you're trying to hide something, which is, I'm sure it's not a very, it's kind of a straw man kind of phrasing of that, obviously. But if a significant portion of people start to mix and start to use CoinJoin transactions, do you see that like changing? So for example, if like every single bank, as soon as they receive customer deposits, then they just mix it around for assuming there would be banks, right? And then or every individual, every business mixes before they send out to their employees. So you don't really know who's getting paid. So first off, do you think that would change anything? I'll just start there, I guess.
Yeah, so I definitely think so. And then there has been rapidly growing adoption of these tools, I think, especially as situations like the Freedom Convoy a year ago now, the Tornado Cash sanctions, as we see more and more attempts by the government to prevent usage of cryptocurrencies in privacy-preserving ways, more people flock to those tools, the Streisand effect there. So we've seen a rapid growth there, and I think we'll see an explosion this year in actual CoinJoin usage as well. And that is definitely, there's two key benefits to that. And that one, the people who are mixing then have a greater anonymity set, because everybody who's gone through that mixing pool of that specific denomination shares an anonymity set together. And so if you keep remixing and that pool grows, everyone gets greater privacy. Ultimately, privacy benefits from strength in numbers. And then the other one, like you said, it can become normalized. I hope that it will. I don't really ever expect privacy on chain to be normalized by regulated entities. So like, I doubt that the US government's going to be like, yeah, you go for privacy. Like, we love that, because ultimately it undermines them because it lowers their control over the individual, which is a good thing. Even if your government's great, they shouldn't have strong control over individuals. So it will always be something that undermines them. So I don't expect explicit approval, but if it becomes common enough within Bitcoin to make them choose, do I want to support Bitcoin and allow privacy, or do I want to just not support Bitcoin? It makes it a much harder financial choice for these regulated entities, where they want to support Bitcoin because they can make money, they can benefit from it. But if the vast majority of people are using privacy tools and they can't easily discriminate against those people, that helps everyone who does use privacy tools to have broader usage, less issues with fungibility, et cetera.
So can the average person really maintain pretty good privacy by just coin joining funds, just as long as they pretty much only send from coin joins? Is that enough, or is there still like a lot? Like, I've heard a lot of, you know, obviously the internet's a big place. Obviously there's a lot of people with agendas and things saying stuff, but I've heard a lot of people saying that like coin join on its own is broken, that it's not sufficient, that if you just coin join, you don't have good enough privacy. So what's kind of your perspective on that?
Yeah, I mean, it's I would say the most important tool in the toolkit for Bitcoin privacy. And if you use an effective CoinJoin protocol like Samurai Wallet and their Whirlpool protocol, it can get you like 98% of the way. The only potential issue, and this will always exist on Bitcoin, and it actually even applies to other cryptocurrencies like Zcash and Monero many times, is how you spend can then undo some of the privacy that you've gained in other ways.
Like timing attacks and such.
Yeah, timing analysis, amount analysis, and then something called the common ownership input heuristic, which basically says if there are inputs in a transaction, they theoretically are all owned by the same entity. And so if, let's say, you have one Bitcoin, you break it up into lots of UTXOs, you mix it all, and then once you go through the mix, you just recombine it all and send it to yourself in one transaction, you gain no privacy, because it's very, very clear on chain that the same person went through, they mixed. Like, yes, we know they went through these mixes, but then we also know they went out the other side and combined all their funds because they recombined to the same amount minus mixing fees, that sort of thing. So there's definitely potential issues there. Any client worth its salt, anything made by people who know what they're doing, will implement what are sometimes called post-mix tools or spending tools. And essentially what those do is they limit the harm that you can do to yourself by preventing you from sweeping all, or at least giving you a very giant warning that tells you you shouldn't just sweep all these funds. And by implementing post-mix spending tools like Samurai has lots of crazy names for their stuff, but Stowaway or Stonewall or Stonewall X2 or Ricochet, all these tools that essentially what they do is they just help you to hide what the spends are actually doing, and they help you to gain better privacy when you're spending than you would have if you were just sending normally. A lot of times they're not necessary, but like one default tool that Samurai Wallet always try to use is called Stonewall. And essentially what it does is it fakes a two-person coin join, what's called a pay join. And it does that in a way that no one on the outside can distinguish, is this a real two-person coin join? Is it just a fake one? And it also tries to hide the amounts that are involved in the transaction as well. So it's one of those things where it tries to add a little bit more privacy on the spend side. But there are always ways that you can harm yourself in every cryptocurrency. Bitcoin's a little bit worse because of the transparency. But if you're using a good coin join protocol and then you're using a wallet that has good default best practices, you're pretty safe after that. And thankfully, the number of wallets that make good choices are growing. Like a recent addition in the last year or so to the privacy space has been Sparrow Wallet on, for Bitcoin. It's absolutely fantastic. It uses all of Samurai's tools, but just a lot of extra functionality, and it implements all of these best practices for you and guides you in doing the right things. So it makes it a lot more approachable.
Yeah, and so it sounds like you can basically maintain pretty good privacy on something like Bitcoin that uses CoinJoin, except it's a lot easier to mess up. And I guess to have like good, okay privacy, it's like set it and forget it. But as far as trying to have really good privacy on something like Bitcoin, it would be, you have to use the exact right tools. You have to be a lot more careful in your actual behavior.
Yeah, yeah, that's definitely true. And that's one of the problems with it being completely opt-in. Like, you have to know the right tools to use. If you've never heard of Samurai Wallet, you probably don't have good privacy on Bitcoin. Like, it's very unlikely at that point, which is a crazy concept, but it's true. So that's one of those big drawbacks, is when it's not something that's baked in by default on the protocol for every user and enforced by consensus, you're going to have ways to harm yourself. And ultimately, most people will use the non-private form of whatever that protocol is, Bitcoin being a key example of most people just send regular Bitcoin transactions, have little to no privacy, and that's just the state of things. But there are the tools. They're just, you have to choose to use them and learn how to use them. And there is somewhat of a barrier there.
Yeah. And so let's move on to ring signatures, which is kind of what has been a hallmark of Monero, which is kind of the decoy model, where when you send, there's a few different potential transactions. Only one of them is real, and otherwise goes that. What do you think about that? What's the breakdown of that real quick?
Yeah, so ring signatures are a fantastic tool. I mean, they've existed for a very long time. I think 2011 was the first mention. And they were included as part of Bitcoin way back in the day, which was a scam, but ultimately led to the birth of Monero, which is obviously not a scam, fair issuance, all that fun stuff. But ring signatures are a very powerful tool. To simplify it, you can think about them as a non-interactive coin join. They're similar in how they function, in that they hide the true source of funds when you make a transaction, and they provide a lot of potential paths backwards when you're trying to chase a specific transaction or input. They provide a lot of potential branching paths backwards that make it very, very difficult to do any sort of tracing. Ultimately, what a ring signature is, I'll just use Monero's current approach because it has kind of iterated over the years. But right now, when you make a transaction in Monero, let's say you're making a transaction that just has one input, to make it simple, you just make the transaction as normal. You don't choose anything. You don't do anything. You don't have to enter a mixing round or anything like that. But when you make the transaction, the Monero wallet will go out. It will find 15 other inputs that match a common spending pattern, essentially like what users normally spend from as far as where the timing is distributed of those outputs. It'll choose those in an intelligent way to try and prevent any kind of timing analysis there. And then your input will be one out of 16 potential inputs for that transaction. And it does that for every input. So if you have two inputs, there would be two inputs, each with one of 16. But ultimately, what that gives you is the immediate anonymity set of 16, but ultimately a much broader anonymity set, because once they start trying to trace backwards, every subsequent input, they have to trace 16 more paths and try to figure out what's going on there. So it provides very good, very simple privacy. The part of it being non-interactive as opposed to CoinJoin is really important, because you're not choosing to gain more privacy. You're not choosing to be a part of any rounds. If an input that you own is chosen as a decoy by someone else, you didn't have anything to do with it. You weren't online. You didn't choose to be a part of that. So there's a lot more plausible deniability. And it's much easier, obviously, because you don't have to do anything special. They're a powerful tool. They're
kind of work variants of ring signatures. Does anyone use it as like an optional thing, or as far as you know, is most coins that use this are just the way it works for the entire chain?
I think some have done. I mean, Monero back in the day used to be able to choose your ring size. So you used to be able to choose. Even at one point, you could choose one ring size, which would be just the true input, which would provide you no privacy on the input side. Or you could choose 200. You could choose whatever you wanted. And ultimately, that was harmful. That was done away with because it didn't lead to good things on chain for privacy. I think there has been some other chains that allowed a similar thing where ring signatures are part of the protocol, but you could choose to just do a ring size of one and essentially just choose transparency. But I think most have done at least like the default being some level of ring signature size, as far as I know.
Yeah. And so now let's go to zero knowledge proofs, right? Which is, of course, what Zcash uses. There have been a few different implementations, but obviously the newest, the Orchard pool in Zcash that doesn't have the trusted setup for inflation purposes. And so basically the kind of key component of that is the zero knowledge part, right? As far as the limited data that gets put out there for potential analysis. So you want to give a rundown really quick on zero knowledge proofs then.
Yeah. So one quick clarification, this is something that I run into a lot, is that zero knowledge proofs are just a piece of what Zcash does. And zero knowledge proofs are actually at the core of what Monero does as well. So that specific piece of things is just kind of a building block of the protocol. Like Monero uses zero knowledge proofs for hiding the amount in almost exactly the same way as Zcash does. But the difference is when you look at the membership proof piece of the transaction, to break that down, the membership proof in Monero is the ring signature that proves that one of these inputs is able to spend, has the right amount of funds, all of that fun stuff. And like we mentioned, that has a smaller anonymity set, plenty for really any threat model, but a smaller anonymity set of one of those 16 inputs with all having their branching history that goes backwards and provides broader anonymity. When you look at Zcash, what you have is actually, it's called a global membership proof, or I think that's the right word. And essentially what that means is that when you prove the input is legitimate in Zcash, you don't have to tie it to a small set of inputs, like 16. And so what you can do is you gain the anonymity set of everyone who's used that specific shielded pool in Zcash. So it's not every transaction historically, but like for Orchard, like you mentioned, it's every time someone has made a transaction within the Orchard pool, either shielding funds or moving funds from shielded address to shielded address. So it does things in a very similar way, but ultimately what it does is it provides a broader membership proof. The issue historically has been those membership proofs have required a trusted setup, like you mentioned. And those membership proofs have been very computationally intensive and storage intensive. So obviously Zcash, the researchers behind Zcash have done fantastic work iterating on that over the years. And Orchard is finally at that state where you don't need the trusted setup. I don't think there's any efficiency gains in Orchard compared to previous protocols, but it's still a relatively heavy transaction, but it's good enough to often be usable. And it does gain that broader global anonymity set, which is an important aspect of privacy because you can gain better privacy that way. Again, it's theoretical and depends on a lot of factors, but you can gain better privacy that way for just the membership proof. Monero obviously still hides amounts. It still hides the recipient address via stealth addresses, similarly to Zcash. The rest of the transaction protocols is almost identical in concept, but that membership proof piece is the one that's slightly different.
Yeah, and so it seems like that's kind of one of the goals is to achieve something like that that has, you know, the global, I guess, pool size membership proof and just very little extra data leakage. I've kind of been on the outskirts of this whole, you know, crypto privacy thing for a long time. I've been much more focused on, up until recently, on like just basic usability and things like that. And so, like, for example, I remember when bullet proofs were implemented in Monero, and because I remember the transaction fees used to be quite high. And then when bullet proofs, they fell off a cliff, just got a lot more efficient with that. And so, for example, I remember over the years, there being a lot of, issues with the decoy model, where, for example, more recently, I believe there's something where if you received a transaction and resent it somewhere too soon, then it had a higher probability that the first of the decoys would be the legitimate one. And then I believe that was fixed, if I remember correctly. And there was a series of things sort of like that. I remember when the forks happened, which a lot of people don't really remember when, I can't remember if it was when RandomX was implemented, but when Monero had a bunch of different forks that people were being told to not claim coins on other chains because they could compromise their privacy on the original Monero chain. And now I was just listening to, I guess, our mutual friend Douglas's podcast talking about the Mordinals or the NFTs on Monero and saying, talking about how they could start harming the privacy of the main chain by doing this. And so it seems like, I mean, maybe it's just, you know, from the casual perspective, maybe I'm sure there's a lot more nuance to it, but it seems like ultimately you'd want to have that kind of, it'd be, again, not to be specific on specific coin or implementation, but just on from a technological perspective, the kind of broad membership proof thing is kind of what we're looking for ultimately.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, that's always been something that like Monero has been open to as well. But like I mentioned, there have been major historical trade-offs. I mean, core issues if you do choose to use that global membership proof. Yeah. So that's the main thing that's been keeping Monero from adopting that. The main thing that I'd mention about Monero's approach is while there have been some small issues and there have been theoretical attacks, none of them have harmed real users. There's no cases of actually tracing Monero in reality. But ring signatures do have that weakness of there is that potential, especially for extremely targeted attacks against a single individual by multiple entities who are collaborating together. And that is just a drawback at ring signatures. It doesn't harm anyone in practice right now. And as we've grown ring size, it's mitigated all of those issues. Even the timing attack, I think that was 2017, that was very quickly mitigated. But it does open up some vulnerability. It's really the only weakness of Monero's transaction protocol. So there is 100% the aim of having a global membership proof there. And I think any privacy protocol will aim for that over a decoy based algorithm as the cryptography and the tooling gets better, gets more well tested, gets more well audited. And I started up a conversation with the Monero community about implementing something like Zcash's global membership proof onto Monero. And that's been picking up pace a lot recently as well, because there's definitely an interest for that. But Monero has been much more focused on decentralization and trustlessness as the core goal, with privacy being obviously the core of the actual function of the protocol. And we didn't want to sacrifice especially the trustlessness for the trusted setup of previous implementations. But like I said, the research around Zcash has been fantastic, and the building blocks for Orchard, like Halo 2, Splunk, I think is another piece of that building, that the building blocks for that protocol. Those have paved the way for there being a path towards other cryptocurrencies like Monero gaining that global membership proof, which is, it's a win for everybody, because it means that Monero users will get better privacy against those targeted attacks. Again, for most Monero users, it doesn't really matter. You have good enough privacy today, but it is important to continue iterating. And it means that ultimately Zcash's technology gets more testing, more eyes on the code, more eyes on the cryptography, which is a win for Zcash, because it means that Zcash will grow stronger as a result. And Zcash can be more trusted as a result from the privacy perspective when more projects are implementing that sort of thing. So it's one of those great things about free and open source software and about openly sharing research and ideas that I hope will continue. And I know there's a lot of licensing interesting choices in Zcash, which probably don't want to get into today. Well, but
It depends. It depends if you have time, because that kind of encompassed the what does Zcash get right kind of part of things. And so I also want to know what you think Zcash gets wrong. And obviously privacy is probably the more important part of this, but if you want a lightning round through a few things that you think that are probably a mistake or, you know, not the right thing to do, then, you know, have at it.
Yeah, for sure. And I'll preface this by saying that I am a privacy advocate first and foremost. I'm not a Monero maximalist. I'm not a Bitcoin maximalist. I want as many people as possible to gain privacy. I don't care if that's Zcash, Monero, Bitcoin, whatever. So when I talk about the things that I don't like or that I see as wrong within Zcash, it's from the perspective of I want to see them improve so that more users gain privacy.
One could even say that you, Seth, are for privacy.
You could. I know it'd be just pulling it out of a hat, but you could say that. So when I look at Zcash, I think the biggest issue from the perspective of a privacy advocate wanting to recommend good tools is the lack of default privacy in the consensus protocol within Zcash. Obviously, that has gotten much better with Orchard, with the implementation of unified addresses, with the push for this concept of auto shielding within wallets. Those are really critical, and they bring more clients into, client being the wallet that you use, more clients into using Zcash properly, which is a huge win. It's definitely a good step in the right direction. The issue is still from me as a privacy advocate. If I want to recommend someone use Zcash, I can't just blindly recommend Zcash and know that whatever wallet they get, they're going to get these strong privacy assurances that Zcash can grant, because they could choose a wallet that has transparent addresses. They could choose a wallet that only does transparent addresses, or that default uses transparent addresses. And they could think they're getting strong privacy when in fact they're just getting the same privacy guarantees as default Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. And so that can be changed. I think it should be changed. It's something that I hope that many, many people within the Zcash community are campaigning for, because ultimately the same privacy assurances being true for every Zcash user, no matter what they understand, no matter what wallet they use, no matter if they're a hardcore techie or just a random person who stumbles upon Zcash, they should all be gaining the same strong privacy assurances. And also when you do that, everyone gains better privacy, because there's less issues with other people using transparent addresses and other tools like that. So that's the biggest one. That's the only one I'll kind of dive into more deeply. Mm-hmm. A few other concerns, and these are more personal preference. This more comes down to like, if you want to save value in Zcash, less important if you just want to use it as a tool for privacy. But I think the core issues that I run into are just the licensing mm-hmm. snafus around Zcash are problematic. I think Bosl is like BOSL, the recent license mm-hmm. that Zugo came up with it's interesting. I definitely understand the heart behind it. But ultimately what a license like that means when it's corruptive, in the sense that if you implement any of the Zcash code that is Bosl licensed into mm-hmm. Your project has to become Bosl licensed, or you have to go and ask, the Zcash community in theory for an exception. And what that means in reality is that lots of people will no longer build on Zcash. They will no longer try to implement pieces of the protocol from Zcash by using the code that Zcash has already written. And so that means less eyes on the code, less research being done, less auditing being done by other people who are implementing Zcash tools or building around it, which is problematic. And it's one of those things where it harms the benefit that we could get from free and open source software, because it ultimately makes it not really free and open source software. It changes it a little bit. And the heart behind it is great, but I think the actual implementation is problematic. The only other one I think I would mention is just the founder's reward, and I can't remember what the names of the other rewards have become over the years, but the shifting of how block rewards are distributed is one that you can take issues with. Again, I understand the heart behind it, especially not the founder's reward, but the more of the dev-focused one that puts money into a single pool to use for dev resources, for funding things like mm-hmm. your podcast. I think there's a lot of potential value in that piece of it. I think the founder's reward is a little more problematic, but in the broader kind of dev tax sense, which there are other words for that, but dev tax is an interesting idea, and one that is a different take on funding that may or may not be good. It very much depends on personal perspective. And it's one where I'm not as much of a hater of the idea as I think a lot of other people.
Yeah, so to split hairs on that one, during the first several years of Zcash, there was the founder's reward was like 20% of the block reward went to one spot. And after that, it was sort of renewed in a certain way where it wasn't the founder's reward anymore. It was split into a certain amount for the developers, in this case, the Electric Coin Company, and then others for a series of community grants and things like that. So it sounds like, obviously the founder's reward is the most contentious one, but as far as what is kind of being used today, you said you don't really have as much problem with that. Do you still have any kind of problem with it? But also, do you have any, thoughts on the way that change was arrived upon?
Yeah, definitely. So the broader idea, I think, is interesting. And if the community agrees on it, and I use that community in the broad sense, not necessarily the vocal community, but like the broad user base of Zcash, if they agree on that as the best method for funding development and ecosystem growth, I think it's totally fine. The main problem I have with it is that when you then choose to use Zcash, you are necessarily choosing to give up some of the reward and give up some of the ultimate issuance on the network to this fund, whether you want to or not. So it becomes not an option at that point for anyone who comes in later. So it's really just decided by those people who decided at that point to renew it. I think some of the qualms that I have and other people have had, that it was actually a very small portion of the community that decided to continue it. I think something like 40 or 45 total people voted as part of that. So there's some issues there in that they're choosing for everyone, and down the line, there's no way for you to opt out of that. Mm-hmm. Whereas the approach like Monero takes is there is just regular fair issuance. It goes to miners. That's it. You just call it a day. Same as Bitcoin, same approach there. The benefit of that is if you come into Monero later on, there's none of the issuance going to other people against your will. They're all going to miners, most of which get sold into the open market, which is that time-proven system of Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. The downside is obviously there's nothing going into a dev fund. There's no guaranteed issuance that will go to fund development or to grow the ecosystem, which can be harmful if then the users of Monero and the community don't give back funds voluntarily by donating to specific things. So it really... it comes down to really ideology at that point, whether you prefer one approach or the other. I think they both have great merit, depending on how you want to approach things. I think the biggest issue really with the Zcash approach is that it ends up being a very small portion of the community that chooses the issuance over the long term. And later people who come in have no way to say yes or no to that. They're just, that's what they're stuck with. Which again, as long as it's transparent and they know that, that's fine, because then they can just choose to be in Zcash or not be in Zcash because of it. But it's just a different approach that has benefits, but also has trade-offs.
Yeah, and so if you could take Zcash as it is today and just mold it into your perfect privacy thing, your perfect privacy project or perfect crypto, what would you do? It seems like part of it was already covered, which is make a default privacy. Now, to clarify that, would it be default or exclusive? Like, would you remove transparent addresses completely, or would you leave the option for wallets to select that?
Yeah, so I think if I was going to build maybe the perfect project out of Zcash, again, in my opinion, some of this mm-hmm. is just totally opinion and isn't necessarily something that like everyone should have. I think obviously on the transaction protocol piece, it should be private by default, no transparent addresses, the ability to opt out with view keys, which mm-hmm. y'all already have. So that the ability to opt out is important, but it needs to be an opt out that does not change how information is revealed on chain, but it only changes if you pass something out of band. And that's the benefit of view keys over something like transparent addresses, is if I choose to reveal information about my transactions to, like, let's just say my tax accountant, and I give him my view key, that's very different from me choosing to make all of the transactions that will be taxed transparent addresses, and therefore harming all of my privacy to the entire world, because everyone can look at that. So making it default privacy with the ability to opt out via view keys would definitely be a key piece of it. The other would be no corporations behind it and no founder's reward. I don't know if I do some sort of dev tax or not. The main problem I have with systems like that is the actual way to vote on how funds get used is tricky. DAOs don't really work, in my opinion. Just community voicing their opinions, I think, is the best, because it's just kind of that rough consensus that has worked in the past, but it obviously has critical flaws as well. So mm-hmm. I would probably lean towards just fair issuance to miners, not worrying about a dev tax and relying on donations back in. Outside of that, I think those are really the main pieces. I mean, I do think that ASIC resistance, or if I could perfectly launch with mm-hmm. multiple ASIC manufacturers, that would be ideal, either one of those. I think in the real world, there's no way to launch without being ASIC mm-hmm. resistant these days, without it being potentially problematic. But I would still be proof of work, not proof of stake, because there still are some unproven issues with that. And the combination of privacy and proof of stake can be problematic. There's some interesting ways to approach that. So if it could be done properly, I might be open to that, but that would probably be it. I mean, ultimately it's that privacy being default. That's the biggest one for me, because that's what I care most about. But the other pieces are more just kind of personal preference.
All right. Well, before we wrap up, there's a little lightning round from the super chat, as it were. SVN says, thanks, etc. He says, question for the normies. Trying to maintain privacy seems like a daunting task. Where does the average person start? And he says, if there's only one privacy action to take right now for someone who hasn't been very private, what would they be? And how do you keep track of all your privacy methods?
Yeah, it's definitely a tricky one. So I'll share a blog post with you that I've written that maybe you can link or share with your chat. But when you're approaching personal privacy for the first time, it really depends on what is most valuable to you. I mean, that's like what I talked about at the beginning, where personal privacy is that idea of choosing how much of yourself you want to reveal to the world. For some reason, that means no social media, no one knowing your real name, hiding in a cabin in the woods, trying to go full anon. Like, some people want that, and they should be justified and able to do that. For most people, I think what that really means is limiting who has access to the data about who you are and what you do. And usually that can start with simple steps like using a browser that preserves your privacy by default. Something like Brave Browser is a good example. Using an email provider that gives you better privacy than like Gmail, et cetera. So something like Proton Mail is a good one there. Using an always on VPN, something like iVPN or Molvod are really good options there. And like the trio of those three things would cover a lot of your bases because it would protect you from your ISP simply spying on what you do. Your browser will protect you from a lot of tracking online. And then the more privacy preserving email will prevent hacks from being as much of an issue and will give you sometimes better privacy when doing email. And obviously email is tricky because a lot of times it just has to be clear text, unfortunately. But those are kind of core ones. But again, a lot of it really depends on what specifically you want to protect. That may mean that you want to just get off social media entirely. I have off everything except for I have a Twitter account that is just for this NIM that I live under now and for educational purposes, for using as a platform. But I think social media almost always is harmful for both a privacy perspective and a social and mental health perspective and lots of other things. But that's kind of a whole other diatribe. But it really does come down to you needing to decide what do you want to protect, how much do you, or how far are you willing to go to protect it, and coming up with an idea of where you want to focus work first and taking baby steps from there to slowly implement improvements in your personal privacy.
So real quick, like 10 second one, have you heard of a zero knowledge coin called Hush that came into the live chat?
It rings a bell from long ago when I was vaguely engaged in like the Zcash ecosystem of a lot of the different forks that went around it. I think I know about it and know a little bit, but it's been a really long time. So something I've heard of, but not much detail.
And finally, a one sentence answer to what do you think of the concept of the Lightning Network's privacy?
Oh yeah, that's one sentence. It's tricky.
or
do another sentences. Link there that you can drop in the chat. But Lightning Network is very complex because it inherits the privacy issues of Bitcoin's base layer, the transparency that we talked about already here, and it has its own set of privacy issues, specifically on the receive side. So normally, when you receive funds on Lightning, you have to reveal information about the node that you're using, which then reveals information about all the channels that you have between different nodes, which then it reveals information about your on-chain activity. There's a lot of cascading issues there. A lot of it can be fixed. A lot of the solutions for fixing it are either being implemented or have been implemented. So there are improvements coming, and it's something I'm optimistic with, but Lightning is definitely a trickier subject. And it's one of those where you should not assume it's private, even though a lot of people have pushed it as being private by default, because there are a lot of caveats. But it does generally have good send privacy, poor receive privacy.
Yeah. Well, fantastic. Thanks for being on. I know you got a bolt, so I'm just going to show your stuff real quick. SethForPrivacy.com is your blog. FoundationDevices.com is foundation that you work for. And OptOutPod.com for the opt-out podcast. Anything else I missed? Anything you want to leave as a parting thought? Oh, I think you got muted there for a second.
Oh, there we go. Sorry, I double muted. Yeah. the only ones I would add would just be Twitter at Seth for Privacy, if you want to follow me there. And then there's a new protocol and social network being built on it called Noster, which is something I've jumped into recently. So you can follow me on there. I think it's Seth at Seth for Privacy, using their interesting ID mechanism. But those are the main places. All of the other contact info I have is all on my blog as well, which you already mentioned. So, yeah.
All right. Well, fantastic. Well, thanks very much for being on, everyone. Thanks for tuning in. And yeah, I'll see you either next month for the next one or next week for my usual news show. Thanks, everyone. Thanks, Seth. And yeah, have a good one.
Have a good one. Thanks for having me on.
Peace.